Let me first say that I'm very glad about the possibility to be in your institute and to do this talk. And right today I'm going to talk about a model that tries to modify general relativity by introducing extra dimensions, or more specifically, by introducing two infinite extra dimensions. So this work has been done together with Stefan Hoffmann and Robert Schneider from LMU and Justin Gould from LMU. So let me start by giving you a motivation why you should be interested in considering models with extra dimensions. So I think that there are two main motivations. And the first motivation is quite obvious, I think. It's just interesting to have a consistent competitor theory to GR. Or to say it in other words, it might be interesting to check whether we can improve any predictions of GR by slightly modifying it. So it's a way to challenge the superiority of GR. There's another motivation, which comes from the cosmological constant. So just to remind you, the cosmological constant is just a parameter that shows up in the Einstein equations. And it does a good job in describing the observed accelerated expansion of our universe. But once you turn on quantum mechanics, there shows up a certain problem. And right, you have to ask, is this parameter robust under radiative corrections? And in order to answer this question, it's very useful to look at a very simple framework. Just consider an effective field theory which is just valid up to the electron mass. So we integrate out all particles that are heavier than the electron. And we would all agree, I think, that we understand that theory quite well. Now we can calculate radiative corrections in this theory to the cosmological constant. And what we find is that the electron gives a contribution which is of the order of 10 to the 24 measured in units of electron volts. But the observed value, on the other hand, is 36 orders of magnitude smaller. It's 10 to the minus 12 in units of electron volts. So in order to fulfill this equation, there has to be a tremendous cancellation going on between these two terms. And that's already happening in this low energy theory. Once you integrate in more particles, the problem gets even worse. So that I would say is the essence of the cosmological constant problem. So it's actually like a theoretical bias, which says that parameter values have to arise generically. And in that case, it's not generical. Right. And as I said, already known particles produce this problem. So how could extra dimensions possibly help? There are two important observations you could make. First, as I said, the problem cannot be solved solely by new high energy physics unless you assume some sort of high and low energy conspiracy. And the second observation is that the value of lambda of this parameter is inferred by gravitational measurements. So these two observations may lead us to the conclusion that maybe the resolution resides in the gravitational center of our theory. So massive gravity would be one example which tries to follow that idea. I will take another route today and consider models with extra dimensions to show or to to motivate these models. It's useful to realize that GR is a very special theory because it's extremely democratic. It couples to all kinds of matter, and as a result of this, once we have a cosmological constant, we will have curvature. That follows trivially from the Einstein equations. And now the idea is to somehow relax this equation by introducing extra dimensions. And that brings us to the concept of deep gravitation, which I'm going to explain now. Let me start by introducing a very simple toy model. And this toy model just consists of a frame, which could be our four-dimensional universe embedded in some higher-dimensional space. So the picture is rather simple. We have two extra dimensions, and we have one point in this extra dimension. Extra-dimensional space corresponds to our universe, and there is a localized energy density, which is equivalent to a cosmological constant, and in the context of brain worlds, we normally call that tension. So the corresponding action includes the six-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert term, and another term which describes this localized space-time homogeneous energy density. And this H is just the induced metric on the brain. So what is nice about this very simple toy model is that there are solutions which look like that. So these solutions have a deficit angle. So what does it mean to have a deficit angle? In this extra dimensional picture, it's very simple. Imagine you go away from the brain to a certain distance, and now you go around the brain and you measure the circumference, and what you will get as a result is smaller than what you would expect from flat space. So it's really like a piece of space-time has been cut out. And in an embedding picture, so actually you can glue together these two lines and you can introduce a fictitious additional dimension, that geometry becomes a cone. And the tip of the cone is the brain. So this picture will become very important later on. So it's really, like a cone. And there's this deficit angle depends on the tension. So once you increase the tension, this cone becomes steeper and steeper. Right. And now what is so nice about this solution is the fact that this first part of the line element, which describes the geometry of the brain, is flat. So in this case, despite the presence of a cosmological constant, there's no curvature. So the general mechanism is the following. So just decompose the Einstein equation in the Einstein tensor, the six-dimensional Einstein tensor, it's new components, which are the brain components, so to say, into a four-dimensional part describing the intrinsic curvature, and into an additional part which collectively denotes all extrinsic curvature contributions. And then the idea of gravitation is simply that there is a cancellation going on between these two terms. This cancellation has not to be a 100% cancellation, so it could take place only partially, but the point is that due to this cancellation, the intrinsic curvature is smaller than you would expect from considering four-dimensional GR. And in this toy model, it's a 100% cancellation, and you get a vanishing curvature on the brain. Of course, this is only a toy model and could never describe our world, because we know we have four-dimensional GR, and there should be some mechanism which restores four-dimensional GR, which we actually measure in our daily life experience. So that brings us to the model of brain-induced gravity. And this model consists of three parts. Again, we have this high-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert theorem here in three dimensions. And there is this induced, that's really the crucial part of the model, that there's an induced 4D gravity term on the brain. So the size of this term is controlled by the Planck mass, which just has the value of our Planck mass, and the integration now runs only over the four brain coordinates. We again have this induced metric on the brain and the four-dimensional Ricci scalar. And the idea now is to localize all standard model matter fields on the brain. So the bulk is completely empty, except for gravity, which is allowed to propagate in the bulk.
Just to check, is H an independent degree of freedom from V, or just?
No, it's not independent. H is the pullback of G on the brain. So that there's a relation between both. That of course depends on which coordinates you choose on the brain. But you could choose always such coordinates, or coordinates in such a way that the H is just the submatrix of G for four-dimensional submatrix. Does that answer that question? So in five dimensions, that's just the DGP model. But to give you an idea of how this model works, let's do something very, very simple but obvious. Let's look at the gravitational potential between two point masses on the brain. And let's try to answer how this potential scales with distance. And what we find is the following. So for large distances, larger than some crossover distance, the potential scales as 1 over r to the power 1 plus n, where n is the number of additional dimensions, so four dimensions. And that means that for large distances, we have the higher dimensional scaling of the potential. And the picture really is that for large distances, gravity leaks into the bulk. Or with other words, this induced gravity term can be neglected in this machine. But for small distances, this induced gravity term kicks in and we recover the four-dimensional scaling behavior. And gravity, the corresponding picture would be that gravity is confined.
Is that the
V-dimensional
scale that you I have one sector which is on the brain, and
right.
Then because everything is localized, Bianchi identity and conservational momentum, and so doesn't have a matter to leak into the brain.
Yeah, matter is not allowed to leak into the brain.
So why doesn't Bianchi identity also forbid cancer or gravitational waves from leaking?
Right. So, right. Gravitational waves can leak into the bulk, and the technical reason is, the reason is that we have this high dimensional Einstein
hilbert
theorem,
it's
like a kinetic theorem which allows propagation in extra dimensional directions. So that means that there can be you can, and we will see that later on, the brain can act as an antenna of gravitational waves, actually. Yeah, that's but only for the gravitational sector, not for the natural sector.
And these probably are just, it's just that I'm thinking that when I'm satisfying beyond the identity, I can't ever have an energy. That's what I'm
doing. But as you can write down the whole set of equations, and you can act this entire dimensional covariant derivative on it, and then you can make use of the higher dimensional Bianchi identity and the 4D Bianchi identity, and you will find that this equation is consistently solved. So that there is no, that's consistent.
Because, like, for example, I would assume at some higher order than the tensor norms and the scale levels, one couple. And if you add one of them to the row to the bar, then how do you go with the other one too?
That's right there. In general, in the gravitational sector, if you allow for an energy flux into the bar, that's included.
But matter somehow doesn't.
Matter and it cannot be. And that behavior is controlled by crossover scale, which depends on the parameter of the model, so it depends on the higher dimensional gravity scale and on the Mach scale, as well as some scale R, I haven't talked about it yet. It's the regularization scale. So once you are considering higher dimensions, you need to regularize the setup, and that in general brings in dependence on that scale. But I come back to that point later. That looks all very nice, but there always has been a problem with these models in higher dimensions, so for six or more dimensions. And that was that people, there are claims in the literature saying that this model in higher dimensions has a ghost on a Minkowski background in a weakly coupled regime. And just to remind you, a ghost is simply a degree of freedom with the wrong sign kinetic term. It leads to the fact that the classical Hamiltonian is unbounded from below, and moreover, it spoils the quantum description of your theory. So you would have to deal with negative norm states, and the vacuum would be unstable, and many other things. So that's really something you do not want to tolerate. We never really understood the reason for that ghost, because there's a simple qualitative counter-argument which goes as follows. So imagine you have six-dimensional gravity and a localized scalar field on some hypersurface, let's say a four-dimensional plane. That's for sure a healthy parent theory, but now you can integrate out that heavy scalar field by calculating these loops. You have the bi-graviton couples to localize bi-particle, that calculation you can do explicitly, and in the low energy limit you find that you get brain induced gravity on a linearized level. So and that's exactly
where is the brain in this setup? It says 60 gravity plus phi localized.
Phi is localized on the brain.
It is localized.
Right. And then you can integrate out that phi, and
so this is called dimension 2 brain.
That would be a dimension 2 brain, yeah.
So having those affects the parent theory.
Right. That you could simply show. It's not difficult to see that the Hamiltonian is bounded from below if you to write down that theory.
Are you sure? Because strictly speaking, I mean, if it were strictly localized, strictly speaking, it's a singularity. So you really need to spread out.
No, yeah. But we always, I mean, the delta function type is an idealization. So sure. you can smear it out a bit. And then...
But if you smear it out, are you sure this works?
Yeah, I'm totally convinced that this is a healthy theory. But why shouldn't it be possible to localize the field on some hypersurface in some high-dimensional space? That would really surprise me. But as I said, this is a qualitative argument, and we performed a solid proof. That was just this observation made us suspicious about that first.
Okay, so I guess you're saying that you assuming that 60 gravity is fine, even if there is a four-dimensional terrain in it.
Yeah,
you just want to show that you can get an induced gravity term.
Yeah, you get an induced gravity term. I mean, that calculation I have done at some point, you can do it on a linear level, and you get linearized by induced gravity, and that theory is now supposed to
have. You have to back to that. So how are you defining this if you were going to talk about this whole
thing? Okay. So when we are working with this theory, we always have the perspective that fields are already confined. But of course, the idea is to have some underlying confinement mechanism in some high energy theory. So you think about it as some kind of defect. So like in Kula mentioned too, you can think about a vortex solution which realizes.
Well, here's where I know these things come up, then I have a normal story. But I'm not sure if I know how to do it.
How
is this scalar field?
Yeah. How to localize the scalar field
on ray light configuration? I mean, with us, or I'm trying to know how to do that.
I mean, okay, so to do it, I mean, in detail, I would need to think about it, but I think it's possible to localize the scalar field on a lower dimensional hypersurface by, for example, studying a vortex solution and considering certain couplings, but we haven't done that calculation. I mean, that's really just an argument. I can show you now
and this argument, so this is only well defined if the mass of the scalar field is less than the atomic mass of the 60 gravity, right?
Right.
So that would be the difference between this and what you want to do, because you want the Planck mass, I guess, in the poverty to be much bigger than the 60 atomic mass.
That's of course a shortcoming of this argument. That argument has been done in different contexts, and there's again this qualitative argument that you could consider a large number of species actually, which then would allow you to get this large induced gravity term nevertheless, but these are all very, very qualitative arguments, I would say, and in the end, that's why I decided we have to do a solid analysis, whether the ghost is there or not. I mean, that's really, just an argument.
Can I ask that? Is it also true that for D equals 5 that there's a ghost about the sitter background?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's another ghost. So the 5D.
So that one will still be there. That one does not go away.
No, that one does not go away. And we will actually, in the end, when we are considering cosmology, we will have indications that the same ghost will be present in the higher four dimensional setup. But on a Minkowski background, the five-dimensional model is fine. This claim has only been made.
This is the self-axis, right? So
right.
Is that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what we have done, we took, first observation was that the mode which was claimed to be the host, that we found a constraint in the system, which is actually the generalization of the GR Hamiltonian constraint, which rendered that mode non-dynamical. And that already showed that, a mode which is not dynamical cannot constitute a ghost because it's not associated with the state in the Hilbert space. But to make this solid, we performed a full constraint, canonical constraint analysis, meaning that we derived the Hamiltonian of the theory on the constraint surface. So there is a whole machinery which allows you to do that, which is a direct constraint analysis, which means that you derive all the constraints in the system and you get rid systematically, you get rid of all redundant degrees of freedom, and you express the Hamiltonian in terms of real dynamical degrees of freedom.
But I mean, I was a little interested in bringing editing. So I would normally say we have just from the gravity sector, we have a scalar constraint, we have a momentum constraint. You're saying somehow this is...
Right.
So what is, I'm not quite sure which this ghost is. So how are you saying this gets...
Right. So what... Right. So what people have seen, so if they take the four-dimensional submatrix of the Hilbert matrix, then on Minkowski background, you can decompose H mu mu into some transverse traceless part plus a conformal mode plus additional parts. And this conformal mode was believed to be a ghost. So in fact, you can, by taking the trace of the Einstein equation, you can derive a dynamical equation for S, which, I mean, looks like a dynamical equation for this conformal mode, which has a wrong, in a certain kinematic regime of the theory, has a wrong sign kinetic term. And, but what was missed is the fact that the 0-0 Einstein equation, which is a constraint equation, can be written in such a way that it is a constraint for S, so that there was this constraint equation people had simply missed. And that was how we, I mean, that was the first observation. And after that, we performed in the canonical framework this analysis.
Right. I don't see how that could be, but I don't want to delay that.
I mean, I would be happy to discuss it. We have a whole paper about it, and let's, I mean, we could discuss it maybe later, and I can really show you the details, but I think, so I want, I mean, to focus on cosmology in that talk, so.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I would just say the normal constraint, that's basically just, you know, it's the statement of the energy there, so.
Yeah, but I would be happy to discuss the details with you, so. Right, and what we found is that the Hamiltonian on the constraint surface is manifestly positive definite. And that settled this issue and allowed us now to further study these models. And that's now the main part. So we were interested in the cosmology of the model, and the idea was to derive modified Friedmann equations in this model, which describe the curvature evolution on the frame. And the assumptions we had to make are quite obvious. We assumed that the frame is the frame directions are homogeneous and isotropic, and we assumed that the bulk is free of any sources. So that implies a cylindrical symmetry around the brain. And but there's a certain issue in two four dimensions, which is that you have to deal with logarithmic divergences. So that's really like in electrodynamics. If you look at a charged spring, you will find that the Coulomb potential diverges logarithmically at the point of the spring. And in order to get rid of these divergences, we were considering a thick crane actually. So we promoted the crane actually to a ring, or if you include the crane dimensions, it's like a cylinder. And in this embedding picture, this really corresponds to a cap cone. So it's like, as I have shown you before, we first had a cone, and the tip of the cone was the crane, and now we kept that cone and this.
So question, so do you need some mechanism to stabilize this?
Exactly, yeah. And right, this red ring corresponds to the crane, and right, and then we assume to have a localized energy momentum tensor of the FRW type, but now due to this compact direction, and we also have a pressure phi direction in general. And
so to speak, for a certain relationship between the radius r and the tension, the cap is exactly flat also?
Yeah. It will turn out that there are static attractor solutions for which this is exactly the case. There are other solutions for which the interior will be not perfectly flat, but we checked that the volume in the interior can be always stabilized. So that was the important consistency check. But of course, we first had to stabilize this compact direction, so the circumference of this object, the physical circumference, and that can always be achieved, I mean, by effectively dialing this pressure and phi direction. But of course, you have to check a posteriori whether this pressure and phi direction corresponds to an equation of state which itself corresponds to physical matter. So that turns out to be a subtle issue, because it's not always possible to stabilize this object. In fact, we will find that there are unstable solutions for which it is not possible to stabilize this object. But there are other solutions, I come to that point, for which it was possible to stabilize it.
So without violating any of the energy condition?
Exactly. So that was what we checked. So we checked that the equation of state parameter for corresponding to p-phi is always bigger than minus one. So a posteriori, once we had the solutions, we could check that.
Is the magnitude of p-phi greater than rho? That's what I would expect.
No, exactly that we could show that is not the case.
Okay.
I mean, I come to it. Yeah.
Yep.
Right. Of course, so once we have introduced that regularization, we have to make, I mean, such a regularization is of course kind of arbitrary, because I mean you could choose other regularizations where you smear out the matter over this interior region, or you could use a Gaussian profile. I mean, there are different possibilities, and we now chose the one where the brain becomes a four-dimensional one object. And right, but we expect, but that can be checked a posteriori, that as long as you are interested in questions taking place on cosmological length scales, so as long as the Hubble length is much bigger than this microscopic scale R, you are insensitive to the microscopic details of the regularization. That's a consistency requirement for our description.
So I guess one argument we made for this is, I mean, people don't tend to take regularizations seriously.
Right.
I mean, for example, the Pauli radars, you introduce these massive ghosts. Which obviously, I mean, physically they would be unstable, but like, you just use it as a mathematical
technique. Yeah.
So it's all right. So I don't know. So maybe even it's okay if you buy this on any dimension, as long as, I mean, at the end of the day, the physics is going.
Well, the argument I would make is you can only do that if you know that what you want exists independence independent of what once you're in that situation, which is the usual QFT scenario, then you're right, you can do any crazy thing and it's all, you know, what will be fine.
Right.
I don't know that that's the case here.
We know now, but I guess maybe it's APIs for people.
I don't know how much they knew and how much they were making. Hopefully they knew that they were doing something sensible, not being completely insane.
I completely agree right. But for us, the point is, and it turns out to be true, that once we are, looking at really large distances, so of cosmological size, and this R is really a microscopic scale, as long as we do that, our results are independent of how we regularize it. Actually, we to check that, we also used another type of regularization in the second run and checked that. But that is something which, which was expected. Right. So let's first take a step back and look at the 5D model, which has already been solved. There, people derived a modified Friedmann equation. And in the 5D case, that's much simpler because there it is possible to embed the brain in a static bulk. And that's ensured by some generalization of Birkhoff theorem in planar symmetry. So once you have this planar symmetry, as in the five-dimensional case, you're sure that you have to deal with a static bulk, and that makes things, of course, easier. In 6D, the symmetry, so we have this cylindrical symmetry, allows for cylindrical symmetric gravitational waves, and these waves we know from 4D are so-called Einstein-Rosen waves. So these are solutions of the full Einstein equations. And these solutions can be generalized to 6D. To understand these solutions, it's useful to make the following ansatz for the metric. What is important about this ansatz is that it only depends on two functions, eta and alpha, which itself both depend on time and radius. And what is so nice about this ansatz, and how that's actually the reason why these two gentlemen could derive these waves, is the fact that alpha fulfills the linear 2D wave equation. And that's not due to linearization. That simply drops out of the Einstein equations once you make that cylindrical symmetric ansatz. And that's, of course, very nice. You have this linear dynamical equation. Then there's this function eta, which fulfills a nonlinear equation as expected, but it's not dynamical, meaning that once you have chosen initial conditions for alpha, eta is completely fixed. So it's just a constraint for it. And what we already see here, if you look at that part of the metric, dx describes the spatial frame directions. So alpha is really like a scale factor, or better to say, the logarithm of the scale factor. So we learn immediately that these Einstein-Rosen waves will affect the curvature evolution on the frame through this dependence. And all, what I still want to say, all physics, all propagating physics is really encoded in this alpha. So that's why. This allows you to derive the existence of these waves. So let's the next slide gets a bit more technical. So what have we done to solve this system? So we introduced a function R0, which describes the coordinate position of the brain, which is a general function of time. That allowed us to derive the induced metric on the brain, which I'm going to explain now. So we have introduced the proper time tau, which is
does alpha become singular in the brain? It is the spread is accelerated.
No, it doesn't become. It's a regularized setup, and we have the interior region and the exterior region.
We solve both regions and have
a regularity requirement in the interior, the axis. Right. We have a proper tower. It describes the proper time on the train, which is related to the bulk time by some gamma factor, which itself depends on the coordinate velocity of the train. And as I said, alpha plays the role of a scale factor. So we can define a Hubble parameter, which is exactly like the ordinary Hubble parameter. So it really describes the expansion rate of the spatial train directions. And as I said, we demand that the circumference r of the train is fixed. So always the subscript 0 means that these functions are evaluated at the train position. So that is the physical circumference, and in general that would be a function of time, of course, because r naught depends on time and this function alpha depends on time. Now we say this object has to be stabilized, and that, as I said, that is that we do by assuming that there is some underlying stabilization mechanism which we effectively implement by introducing this pressure in phi direction. But as you pointed out, it has to be made sure that the corresponding equation of state is healthy. I mean, it corresponds to physical nature.
And you say you check all the matching conditions?
I come to the matching conditions now. So right, now we have the solutions, I mean, in terms of this linear wave equation inside and outside, and now we have to match the equations in the interior and exterior, and that can be done in a coordinate independent way or in a covariant way by using Eastside junction conditions. And Eastside junction conditions says that the difference in the extrinsic curvature between one side and the other side of the frame is related to the energy momentum tensor on the frame. So that means that we get a matching equation for each component of the energy momentum tensor. So there's a row matching equation, which looks like that, which is already nice because it gives us some kind of modified Friedmann equation. So the first two terms correspond to the standard for the Friedmann equation. And now there's this additional modification term, which is controlled by the crossover scale. And we already see, once we make that crossover scale bigger, the modification gets suppressed. That's already nice. There's a p-matching equation, which gives us the standard energy conservation equation. And there's a p-phi-matching equation, which is a bit complicated, but which allows you to express p pi. So once we solve the system, this equation will tell us what the value of p pi is, and then we check that. Then we can take the ratio between p pi and rho and check that this ratio is bigger than minus one. That's what we have done to infer whether this setup can be stabilized in a physical way or not. Right. So that looks, I mean, all very nice, but of course there's a problem with these equations. There's this factor gamma, and that means that is not a closed system of on-plane equations. And that's of course clear. I mean, this gamma depends on the radial profile of alpha. And it's clear that we have this dependence because at the initial moment of time you can prepare a wave packet far away from the frame, and then if you let time evolve, this wave will propagate towards the frame and eventually hit it and influence its evolution, and that influence is exactly mediated by this function gamma, which means that you, in order to solve the system, you really need to solve the full system. So the bulk equations, the partial differential equations in the bulk, and the matching equations. There's no, I mean, other way.
Yeah, let's get a question. So rho, like for the physical origin of p phi, like, so rho and p are obviously supposed to correspond to the matter density and the pressure of of your matter on your brain.
Exactly.
But how does, is P5, that's associated to, that's the pressure in the vibration.
In this angular direction, right? And that has to be adjusted such that the whole setup is stable.
Right, so you have to have exactly the right amount of P5 pressure.
Exactly, to stabilize it.
So
yeah,
what
do
you mean by stabilizing?
The
size is
such a defined static solution.
R is the I mean R naught is the coordinate position. And R naught, I mean
capital R you want to keep it fixed, that's
capital R we want to keep fixed. So the full metric, I mean the induced one contained, I mean that true.
That should use wire time.
But here you see that the physical circumference corresponds to exactly.
You want to keep that fixed.
That we want to keep fixed. Right. Okay.
So that sounds a little bit unphysical, but I don't know.
Yeah.
You saw it's P5 to evolve in a way that keeps.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about.
But the idea is
just regulated.
I mean,
at the end of the day, it is also dependent on this, then maybe.
So you can have
cosmology
with any energy density and pressure, but you have to have just the right P by.
Of course, I agree. You could improve that by dynamically resolve that sector. So, I mean, there are proposals. You could introduce some shared Schwarz-like mechanism. So, actually, you put an axionic field on that compact direction. You look at topologically non-trivial solutions where it winds around that, and then you could, I mean, then you could check whether such a construction leads to a dynamical stabilization. That we haven't done. What we have done is really this effective way of implementing it. But I agree, that is something you could work out the microscopic details, and I think it's possible to do that. But we said our working assumption was that there is a working stabilization mechanism, and under that assumption we wanted to know whether there is a nice cosmology or not. If we don't find a nice cosmology, we do not have to think about it any longer. If we find a nice cosmology, we would say, okay, in the next step, check whether this was really justified. So that's
When you say you have to solve the 60 equations, would it be enough if I told you, so gamma is an explicit, some implicit function of time that depends on?
It depends on, for example, R naught. And
so if I gave you gamma if I just can't hand it to you as an explicit function of time, then you could solve that thing. You wouldn't know what was a valid function of time.
Because that depends on the function alpha. So actually you see it here. If that's constant, R naught depends on alpha, so the time dependence of R naught. And that goes into gamma here. So you're sensitive to what the wave to the wave content of the bound. That's
you like assume there is no incoming wave.
Yeah, that you can assume, but then it's getting tricky as well because in 2D there is no local criterion to exclude incoming waves. So you would need a differential criterion to exclude incoming waves. But in 2D, that's a non-local equation. Of course, we tried that as well. You can write down this non-local relation, but then you end up with non-local equations, which is in terms of difficulty exactly the same as solving the whole system, actually. So that's why we decided to solve the whole system numerically. And in the rest of my talk, I'm going to present the numerical results. So actually, what is nice, this alpha fulfills a 2D linear wave equation, which means that there are stable numerical schemes to investigate the system. So it was I mean, rather doable to, I mean, what was just doable to do the numeric stem. Because once it gets, you have to deal with nonlinear equations, it's not so easy to have a stable numerical scheme. Right, so let me present you the numerical results we got. So for simplicity, I mean, we also look at other cases, but let's consider on the pure tension case. So, and it's a subcritical case, so the value of the tension is below this fundamental body gravity scale. And we find two types of solutions. So what have we done? We chose an initial profile for alpha, which was chosen such that the initial value of Hubble was not zero. So we gave the system an initial push so that we started out with a non-trivial Hubble value. And what we found were these degravitating solutions, for which we found that after about one Hubble time measured in this initial Hubble value, the Hubble value settled to zero, meaning that exactly the static deficit angle solution I presented before is approached. So this really has shown that this static deficit angle solution is a stable solution and an attractive solution, and at least in the circular regime, the parameter regime. And we also checked that the equation of state for p5 in that case is always bigger than minus one. In fact, for this in the pure tension case, for when in the static case, you can also calculate p5, and you find that in that case it's even exactly zero. But during the process of relaxation, it's of course not zero, but it's always above minus one, and allows you to stabilize the system without which allows still for the possibility to do it with physical matter. That's a solid state. And that happens for dust and radiation too. There we also approach a static track resolution. So that we call an example of an empty
decoration. For sure, we have static for dust and radiation.
I mean, there in the setup, there are static solutions when you have dust and radiation on the brain, and these solutions are simply approached. I mean, another question is whether this is phenomenologically interesting, but that's first what we find. There's another type of solution which is not so nice. In that case, Hubble grows on a much so shorter time scale. So compared to here, measured units of initial Hubble. And if you look at the values on the y-axis, so that growth is really rapid compared to the change in Hubble in the gravitating case. And moreover, what we see is there's a notion of effective energy density. So as I said, you have this induced gravity term, and you have matter localized in the brain, and you can combine those to an effective energy density. And what you see is that this effective energy density, which is sourced in six-dimensional gravity, becomes negative, and the equation of state for p5 falls very fast below minus one, which shows that there's no hope for physically stabilizing that thing. And that is exactly something very similar is happening in the DGP model with the self-accelerating crunch. If you embed that self-accelerating crunch in a Schwarzschild bulk, you also find that the effective energy density becomes negative. You get that kind of unstable behavior. And for that case, people have shown that there are perturbative ghosts. And we haven't done such a calculation, but we conjecture that the same would occur in that case as well. So we qualify these solutions as being pathological. Right. And let me now show you the corresponding regime and parameter space. So what you see here is the initial energy density plot versus the crossover scale measured units of the visual Hubble. There are three regimes. There's this green regime corresponding to degravitating solutions. There's the red regime corresponding to these unstable solutions. And the gray regime, that is the supercritical regime that we haven't investigated so far. But in the end, I will say a few words about that. So, but these are the two regimes and for which we have these degravitating and unstable solutions. And both regimes are separated by a physical singularity, meaning that there's a yellow-orange band around this line, which you probably can hardly see, which is extremely narrow. And if you start in that narrow band, you hit a singularity within a finite time. So that really means you cannot dynamically go from that region to that region or the other way around. These regions are really separated. And we are now interested in the degravitating case and in the question whether these degravitating solutions could be phenomenologically viable. And in order to be in this green region, you have two bounds have to be fulfilled. So you have to be above that line, which we call the stability line. And it was possible to derive an analytic expression for this line. And that is given by this criterion. And there is a criticality bound, which makes sure that you are below the gray area. And both these bounds can be combined to one requirement on the parameters which has to be fulfilled in order to be in the green reach. So effectively, that means that the crossover scale has to be smaller than the regularization scale. And that's, of course, problematic, because since here we have a microscopic scale, and here we have the crossover scale, which should be of the order of today's Hubble length. So that means that for a phenomenological viable model, these degravitating solutions are unfortunately ruled out. Right, and the gray region is still unexplored, but I can make it a bit more precise. So a viable solution requires two things. We need a Fermi regime for early times, which means that this combination has to be much bigger than one, so the crossover scale has to be very large. And as I said before, we want to be insensitive to the microscopic physics inside the brain, and that is given by that requirement. And both requirements are, of course, incompatible with having a degravitating solution. That's why they are ruled out. Interestingly, the super-accelerating solutions are compatible with both. So there is a Fermi regime, but once the modification sets in, the whole system, flows out. And that's why we have to dismiss these solutions. And in the end, there's a small remaining window of opportunity, I would call it, which is the supercritical regime. And right, but let me now explain you why the supercritical regime is a bit tricky. That's
the one that's important for that Roger concept.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And on my last slide, I think I put some exciting results on that. Right, but why is it tricky? So if you look at the static solutions I've shown before, so for subcritical you have this cone which opens, and if you increase the tension, the cone gets steeper and steeper, and once you get supercritical, it bends over and forms a second axis, so we have an axis down there in the interior of the brain, and if you go in radial direction, you would move to the brain, and then you move up there, the circumference becomes smaller and smaller, and there's some second axis, which in general is a naked singularity for these static solutions. So what's about that singularity? And we said, okay, before we investigate the supercritical regime for the DGP or the generalized DGP model, we have to better understand that set up in a simpler configuration. So we took a step back and investigate supercritical cosmic strings in 4D. That's the simplest thing you could do. And you could apply the same numerics I presented before, and I can show you our results on that. They will be published soon, actually. So we found that the brain does no longer have a Minkowski vacuum, as for the other static solution. It approaches a De Sitter geometry on the brain, so that the Hubble value approaches a constant. Moreover, there's a horizon form between the scaling singularity and the brain. I can show you how you can see it in a short movie. And the whole geometry becomes cigar-shaped, and that cigar is growing. And we were even able to, in that case, to derive analytic solutions, at least for the interior. That's why you have all these twiddles here. That are just the interior metric functions. And so scaling solutions which only depend on R via the ratio of R divided by T. And that allows to derive an analytic relation between tension and Hubble. I mean, we have the exact relation, but in a near critical regime, this can be approximated in a very simple way. And this dotted line up here is not a fit. It's really an analytical prediction. And
what is lambda?
Lambda is the tension on the brain. So that, in the supercritical case, that ratio is bigger than minus one. And that's the relation between Hubble and the tension. And we see in the numerics that this is indeed approached. And I want to show you the corresponding.
That's kept back to the 60th rank?
No, as I said, we took a step back and investigated first the 4D case, but we have already shown that this goes in 60 as well. It's just for simplicity.
It's just for.
We first wanted to settle the issue about these supercritical strings, and let me show you something. So that's the subcritical geometry. So the red region is the interior region, which is almost flat, and we have that cone in the outside region, and the boundary between the red and the green region is the brain. So that's the subcritical case for which we have shown that it is stable. And what we have done in the numerics, we gave the system a push by choosing non-trivial initial conditions for alpha. And I can show you what is happening. So the system gets perturbed, but settles back to the static configuration. So it's just a stable solution.
So here the third, the z direction is just some unphysical embedding direction.
Exactly, it's an embedding. So the universe or the bulk is really the surface of this object. Right. But now we did the same in the supercritical case. So
where is the brain? The brain is there.
Yeah, the brain is between the green and the red region. That's the flat, almost flat interior, and here we have this cone, and down there is naked singularity. And now, if you start the time evolution of that system, you see that the system starts to expand and becomes cigar-shaped. So that's what you observe. And now, if you have this red ring here, which you should follow in the second one. So imagine Alice sitting down there, the singularity, and Bob is sitting at the brain, and Alice wants to tell Bob about the singularity down there and uses a flashlight. And this flashlight sends out a ring of photons, which is given by that red line, and now follow this flashlight signal. So it travels towards the brain, but then it starts to freeze out, and that means that we have a horizon sitting in here. It's just to give you a visual impression.
Surely you could send a gravitational signal. Surely you could send a gravitational signal from the singularity too.
Yeah, sure, you could.
So it's not a horizon in the usual sense.
But why is that? I mean,
because surely you could travel through the bulk and see.
No, there is no bulk here.
I mean, if you were looking at light, light is the slider.
Unless I misunderstood the picture.
The picture is the bulk. That's just an embedding display.
It's an embedding picture. So the bulk is the surface of this cigar or whatever. It's just to visualize the whole geometry. So if you, I mean, the interior is given by that red region. And if you would start in the interior at the axis, that would be that point. And if you go in a radial direction, you would go along that line. And at that point, you would cross the frame, and then you would carry on in the outside region. And at some point, you would hit that point down there.
In what sense do you say it's a naked singularity? It sounds like a singularity of many horizons.
I mean, there's a conical singularity, which is now no longer naked. It's shielded by this horizon. But
in other words, it just sounds like there's a black hole.
There's matter. I wouldn't say black hole. So it's here we have a conical singularity corresponding to some matter sitting down there. So I mean, the conical singularity is always produced if you have matter on an infinitely thin string.
Yeah.
And so you would say there is matter down here. But what is very nice and what we have shown is that in the dynamical case, you can choose initial conditions such that this is smoothed out down here. So that you can actually get rid of the singularity. You still have the horizon, but in that case, you wouldn't say you have matter down there. I mean, you can choose initial conditions such that this singularity is no longer there.
I'm still confused about why you're worried. Like in a black hole, I have a singularity in the middle, but I don't worry about it as an observer outside because I'm protected by it.
Same as here.
Naked singularity, calling it that, makes it sound very dead.
No.
I mean, this sounds not dead.
This one is no longer naked, but in the static case, I mean, that's the dynamical case, the real attractor solution, but there are these static solutions which people have discussed so far, and in these static solutions, there is no horizon, you only have that singularity. That's, of course, the problem. And we have shown that once you alter the system dynamically, so if you relax the assumption of having static geometry, then you find it's
the static solution is unstable.
It's unstable, and you approach.
So strictly speaking, the static solution is a solution, but it's just if you perturb it slightly, it's
exactly.
Like a black hole. Like that.
Exactly.
Well, that also sounds just like a normal.
Yeah,
it's
black hole. I would say there are similarities, it's one. Example for the cosmic censorship hypothesis, actually. Right.
It's no reinvention.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
We should probably wrap up.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Right. So let's give me a very short summary. First result was that brain-induced gravity on the Minkowski background is close to 3. That allowed to investigate the cosmology. We found a dynamical degravitating solution, which approached that static cosmic string, or generalized cosmic string solution, which unfortunately turned out to be not viable. There are these unstable solutions we dismissed. And the supercritical regime in this model remains for investigation. But there are first results without brain-induced gravity, for which we see that this static solution with a Minkowski vacuum on the brain is not stable, but the system approaches this inflating brain solution, which also contains a horizon. All right. And yeah, that's it, actually. Thank you for your attention.
Any quick question?
So you talked about the regularizations, right? I thought you were going to tell us about an upper bound. How about E5? You only gave us a lower bound, unless I missed something.
on the regularization?
So you if I understood you correctly, you had the same as if you had P pi over rho being there was some regime where P pi over rho is greater than minus one, meaning we weren't by
Right. I just had it in words, So for the deep gravitating case, we could see. I mean, I can show you the plot in the paper where you can see, and there you find that that p phi divided by rho is always bigger than minus one.
Okay, that's one energy condition. I agree importantly, but
right.
What about the rest? So is p phi over rho in that same regime less than one or no?
It's less than one. Yes. It's always less than one. I mean, if you're interested,
it's probably always negative.
It's in that case, it's always negative, and approach is zero for this case.
Unless you're defining things opposite than I would. But you have some ring,
right,
which would normally like to collapse.
Yeah, but it's not true.
So you need some pressure, not tension.
It's not true if you put a cosmological constant on that ring. That has to be. I mean, if you.
Oh, okay, so you see that it's being balanced by a cosmological constant.
Yeah. Now, if you would take a different type of matter, the story would be different. And I think I have these plots as well in the papers. Also, let's look at them. Maybe write a bit. But that's the reason, because we put a cosmological constant on it and. That tends to let expand everything, yeah. And that's why we need a negative pressure to stabilize the system. Yeah, but that's how we want to stabilize it if that's negative.
Sure.
I agree, it's totally counterintuitive when you're coming into it.
Well, no, it's just saying it's the cosmological constant that's doing the work,
right.
Keeping this thing.
You just talk his intuition here, so
Also, Newton was very smart.
You have to break these things on the curve.
All right. Well, since it's 12:15, how about we continue questions over lunch?
Okay. Thank you.